Hello, welcome to Cincinnati Association for the Blind Radio Reading Service. This is David Ness, and for the next half hour, we're going to be reading this week's edition of City Beat, and I'm not sure if y'all are aware of it, but it appears that City Week is now being published every 2 weeks, so this is the most recent edition of City Beat. And the first article is out of City Beat's Arts and Culture section. The article is entitled, At Desk 88 with Ohio Senator Sherrod Brown. We chatted with Brown about the inspiration behind his recently published book, Desk 88, Eight Progressive Senators Who Changed America. And this article is from Jason Gargano. The floor of the U.S. Senate contains 100 desks, most of which were handcrafted from mahogany more than a century ago. Desk 88 belongs to Ohio's Sherrod Brown, a Mansfield native who was elected to the Senate in 2006. Inspired by predecessors who sat at the desk over the years, Brown has just published Desk 88, Eight Progressive Senators Who Changed America. Brown's book topic of choice makes sense. He's been a tireless champion of progressive causes since first getting into politics in 1974, the year he graduated from Yale University with a degree in Russian studies. Brown spent 11 years researching and writing Desk 88, and it centers on eight men who each made their particular progressive mark on the Senate and beyond, in chronological order beginning in 1927 and covering a 60-year period. Hugo Black of Alabama, Theodore Green of Rhode Island, Glenn Taylor of Idaho, Herbert Lehman of New York, Al Gore Sr. of Tennessee, William Proxmire of Wisconsin, Robert Kennedy of New York, and George McGovern of Minnesota. That's incorrect. He's from South Dakota. The senator profiles are interspersed with chapters titled Thoughts from Desk 88, in which Brown relays his incisive musings on politics past and present. Senator Brown, who was reelected to a third term last year, took a few minutes out of his busy schedule on the eve of Desk 88's publication to connect with City Beat. And here's the interview. City Beat, what compelled you to write this book and how did you choose which senators to focus on? Sherrod Brown, I always had in mind that I wanted to write about these senators and what they did to move the country forward in a more progressive way. I'm not exactly sure how I picked these eight. Some of them I knew a little bit or a lot about. The one I know nothing about, Glenn Taylor, is in some ways the most interesting because he was kind of a character, but he played a pretty big role in the mid-20th century American politics. He was the one I had to struggle to find out things. He wasn't particularly well known to history. Some of them, obviously, Kennedy and McGovern and Proxmire and Hugo Black, were well-known figures, and they kind of all jumped out. City Beat, what did you learn while researching Desk 88 that you can use in today's political climate? Sherrod Brown, I learned that in some sense nothing changes. I think Trump will go down as the worst president in American history, certainly the worst in my lifetime, but it's not the worst time for our country. It's not the divisions of Vietnam, it's not all that was happening in civil rights, it's not the Depression, it's not the Civil War. I've thought more about this lately and I see how resilient we are. A lot of people are pessimistic with Trump and his threats to democracy. We should be alarmed and concerned in pushing back, but not pessimistic. I think I learned that voters in the end do the right thing and that our institutions, even though they're under duress with Trump, really do protect us. City Beat. Yet it is surreal how quickly Republicans have flipped on so many of their long-standing core issues, from immigration to Russia to deficits to tariffs to appease Trump. Sherrod Brown. There are some Republicans of conscience that are increasingly troubled by this, but most of them grumble quietly and go on. One of the things this book is telling me, using the 60 years that is covered in it, is that history will not be kind to the crowd of Republicans that have enabled this president. City Beat, you're currently the only statewide elected Democrat in Ohio. How did Democrats win back Ohio? Sherrod Brown, we win back Ohio by paying more attention to rural communities. When I say rural communities, I just don't mean Batavia. I also mean smaller cities like Hamilton and Middletown and Springfield and Lima and Mansfield. Many rural voters don't like Democrats' positions on gun safety, reproductive choice, and marriage equality, but they do like a Democrat that fights for their wages and their benefits and education for their kids. And then we continue to build our increasingly large margins in urban areas. Look at Hamilton County. No Democrat other than Lyndon Johnson in 1964 carried Hamilton County in decades till President Obama in 2008. I won Hamilton County by something like 60,000 votes, and it's going to get bigger next time, but we don't do as well with people in Chillicothe and Portsmouth, so we've got to talk to people in smaller communities and show them we're on their side. City Beat. How did having another writer in the House impact your approach to Desk 88? Brown's wife is longtime newspaper columnist and author Connie Schultz, Sherrod Brown. She read the book back in 2010 and said, "You're not close to being finished," which was kind of crushing because I thought I was. She also said, "You need more of you in this. A historian could have written about these 8 senators, but since you're sitting in the Senate and you're sitting at their desk and you're feeling and seeing something different, you have to put more of yourself in the book." That's when I came up with the construct of the 8 senators alternated with thoughts from Desk 88, which made the book much more whole and much more substantive and deeper than it would have been. I live with one of the best writers in the Midwest, if not the country. It is clearly a better book because of whom I'm married to. There's no question about that. And Sherrod Brown will discuss and sign Desk 88 at 7 p.m. on November 22 at Joseph Beth Booksellers, located at 2692 Madison Road in Rookwood. And for more information, go to josephbeth.com. Next article, this is out of City Beat's news section. The article was entitled, "Cincinnati Youth Work to Find Their Own Solutions to Neighborhood Issues and Disparities in the Justice System." Members of Cincinnati's youth councils do community service, convene youth summits, and present policy recommendations to city leaders, all before they're old enough to vote. This article is from Nick Swartzel. Gracie Perez-Vasquez, 16, has plenty on her plate, including attending Dater High School, prepping for the ACT, and working with a group of other young people from across the city to draft policy recommendations to present to city officials. Vasquez is one of a number of young people involved in Cincinnati's youth councils, groups of civically engaged students pushing to make a difference in neighborhoods that sometimes see big challenges. Though she lives in West Price Hill, Vasquez is a member of the East Price Hill Youth Council, which launched last year along with another council in Lower Price Hill. She describes the youth council process as beautiful. "Normally you'd see a lot of kids fighting," she says. "I would have never thought a whole group of kids could be united and work with each other." The concept of youth councils has been growing over the last decade in Cincinnati. The first sprouted in Avondale in 2006. Another popped up in Madisonville in 2012. In 2016, the Urban League of Greater Cincinnati's Community Police Partnering Center helped launch a collaborative youth council in Westwood and East Westwood with the community councils there. The next year, it expanded the model to Bond Hill, Walnut Hills, the West End, and Wilton Hills. The groups convene to talk about youth issues, tackle service learning projects, and work in their communities. DeMontez Blackman, 16, is part of the Westwood Youth Council and also helped present juvenile justice recommendations in October. He's enthusiastic about the program. "It was very interesting," he says, "because it's something that I've never done. Working with other kids and being around kids from other neighborhoods, seeing what they like and what their thoughts are about issues." Community Police Partnering Center Executive Director Dorothy Smoot says the councils are a way to bridge the gaps that young people sometimes find in their communities. "We heard that there was a disconnect between young people and their community," Smoot said in an interview after a youth council session at the Urban League's Avondale headquarters this summer. "Research will tell you that it is one of the reasons for violence in the community. Young people need to feel safe, protected, loved, etc. by their communities. And if you're disconnected from a community, you're not getting these feelings. Our vision is voice, choice, and shared responsibility to teach young people how to do those things. We also have to teach adults how to make space for those things. Adult members of Cincinnati Community Councils who work to supervise the youth councils agree. They say young people are capable of advocating for their interests and speaking their minds. Connie Benton is a member of the Winton Hills Community Council who also works with the youth councils. I don't want the youth council to be a place where people just talk at them, she said at a recent meeting of youth council supervisors and supporters. I want to see these young people rise up. The youth councils overseen by the Partnering Center are supported by the city's human services funding earmarked for violence prevention measures. More may be on the way. The Cincinnati Recreation Commission would like to foster the councils in other communities around the city. The work the councils have completed this year alone has been considerable. Representatives from various youth councils meet bi-monthly earlier this year to plan a youth summit that took place in July at New Prospect Baptist Church. That event drew scores of young people as well as representatives from the City of Cincinnati, Cincinnati Police Department, the region's legal community, and more to talk about the relationship between young people and the justice system. Youth planned and facilitated the whole conference with some assist from adults. Some young people, including Vasquez and Blackman, took that conversation a step further last month, presenting to city officials the recommendations they have drawn up for addressing disparities in the region's juvenile justice systems. Those disparities are large, though about 30% of Hamilton County's population under the age of 18 is black. 80% of those who find themselves in the county's juvenile courts are black. CityBeat found in a deep dive into the juvenile justice system in September. Similar racial differences ripple through other parts of the justice system and beyond. They can be found in the data charting police use of force, arrests in neighborhoods and schools, and among those who become victims of violence. Many of the young people touched by those dynamics come from predominantly black neighborhoods with median household incomes well below the city's as a whole. That has a lot to do with socioeconomics, Smoot says. Where are the economic disparities but in communities where there are African-American youth? Until the changes that are beginning to occur in Avondale, where were the resources, she asks. No stores, no places to work when you're a kid, no places to go for children. They're not in an environment that is economically conducive for making good choices. When you go to the neighborhood school that is not the magnet school, your opportunities are more limited and your network is more limited. You don't have the choices to do something different. How does a community address those disparities? Part of the answer involves asking young people themselves, youth council advocates say. A program launched by the Children's Law Center, CLC, and funded by the Greater Cincinnati Foundation engaged 15 young people from various youth councils who met every Friday over the summer to discuss those issues and come up with recommendations for city leaders. Most of the group also had summer jobs but were compensated for their time. The group also received leadership training from Cincinnati-based youth engagement nonprofit Youth at the Center. CLC Executive Director Asina Beck says the program has been a few years in the making but that the timing has been critical this year. A series of shootings involving teens as young as 14 focused the city's attention on violence in some Cincinnati neighborhoods, making the input of young people in those communities even more vital, Beck says. Their voices are what matter, she says. We as adults are always assuming that we know what is best for youth and we know what they want, but a lot of times we find that we're wrong. This is a time when the city seems to be paying more attention when the recent violence, so it's perfect time for them to weigh in. And all the youth we've worked with say they've never been asked. On October 16, six youth council members presented their recommendations to Cincinnati City Manager Patrick Dehaney, Cincinnati Police Chief Elliot Isaac, Cincinnati Collaborative Agreement Sustainability Manager Jason Cooper, and other officials. Those recommendations included youth representation on the Collaborative Agreement Created Managers Advisor Group, which oversees police accountability efforts and reviews continued implementation of the city's landmark 2003 policing reforms. Youth also said they thought both young people and police could benefit from more training about how to engage with each other. More efforts to get police officers out into the community in non-enforcement situations and more diversion programs and other alternatives to the traditional justice system. The city says it's taking those ideas seriously. A spokesperson said city officials are working on ways to implement key points made by the youth council members and will have more specifics about how it is doing so soon. The city administration was pleased to partner with the Children's Law Center, the Urban League of Greater Southwestern Ohio, and youth at the center on this important topic, the city said in a statement. We look forward to going over the recommendations and discussing possible paths forward with the organizations, the Cincinnati Police Department, and our elected officials in the coming weeks. The City of Cincinnati remains committed to exploring ways to expand partnerships with a range of community-based organizations to create platforms and meaningful opportunities for young people to voice their opinions and inform the decisions that will impact their lives. Vasquez says the experience was valuable. It was exciting being able to present in front of the city manager and the police chief because I look up to people like Martin Luther King and Cesar Chavez, she says. In my mind, youth are fighting for their voices to be heard. It's an opportunity to change our community. Next article, this is also out of a City Beat news section. The article is from Nick Swartzel and is entitled, Kentucky Governor's Race Goes Into Extra Innings. Could the state's General Assembly decide the close election between Governor of Kentucky Matt Bevin and Attorney General Andy Beshear? On November 6, Kentucky Governor Matt Bevin's reelection campaign formally requested a recanvass of the votes cast in the state's November 5 gubernatorial election after vote tallies showed him roughly 5,000 votes, or 0.3% of the electorate that voted, behind Kentucky Attorney General Andy Beshear. Kentucky Secretary of State Allison Lundergan Grimes called the election for Beshear, but Bevins has refused to concede the race and wants the state to double-check the data transmitted by each county clerk to the Kentucky Board of Elections. Such recanvass efforts rarely produce a significantly different outcome. After the recanvass is done, it's unclear what will happen next in the razor-thin contest. Bevin could also formally contest the results of the election, though he must cite grounds for the contest, be they campaign finance violations by a rival candidate or particular issues with the voting process. During a speech November 5 in which Bevin refused to concede, he cited irregularities in some areas of the state but did not provide specifics. The people of Kentucky deserve a fair and honest election, Bevin campaign manager Davis Payne said in a statement. With reports of irregularities, we're exercising the right to ensure that every lawful vote was counted. Should Bevin file to formally contest the election, what would happen next is somewhat up for debate. Kentucky State Senate President Robert Stavers, a Republican, said November 6 the state's GOP-dominated legislature could decide the contest. But the state's process for doing that is also hazy, some political experts say, and Bevin would need to provide hard evidence of specific problems with the voting process. Under this scenario, Bevin would need to call a special session of the Kentucky General Assembly, including 8 members of the Kentucky House of Representatives and 3 members of the Kentucky Senate. Those representatives would consider the evidence presented and make a final determination on the outcome of the race. The state last dealt with a contested gubernatorial election in 1899 when Republican William S. Taylor beat Democrat William Gable by less than 400 votes. Gable challenged the results, claiming voter fraud had occurred. The Kentucky General Assembly created a committee to investigate the election results. But during tumult around the contested election, Gable was shot by an unidentified assassin. The General Assembly Committee ruled he was the winner of the election, but he died of his wounds a few days later. Bevin is no stranger to thin electoral margins. He won his 2015 GOP gubernatorial primary, but just 83 votes over James Comer, now a state representative. In amassing his slim lead, Beshear flipped some suburban northern Kentucky counties that Bevin handily won in 2015, and that fellow Republican President Donald Trump took up the presidential election the next year. Beshear narrowly won Kenton County and turned in a somewhat more robust performance in Campbell County. Bevin won both those counties in 2015, grabbing 57% of the vote in Kenton. This time around, Bevin easily took Boone County with 56% of the vote. He also took a large red swath of the central part of the state. However, that wasn't enough to turn back Beshear's decisive victories in the more liberal and populous counties containing Lexington and Louisville. Beshear also took a run of counties, Bath, Boyd, Carter, Elliott, and Rowan, on Kentucky's eastern side and a handful of others around the state. Beshear's apparent victory comes despite, or depending on who you talk to, partly because of, Bevin's alignment with Trump, the president who won Kentucky overall by 30 points in 2016, swooped through the bluegrass state to campaign for Bevin. "You're sending that big message to the rest of the country," Trump said at the rally. "It is so important. You have to get your friends. You have to vote. If you lose, it sends a really bad message. You can't let that happen to me." Down ballot, Republicans did get a victory in the Attorney General's race, where first-time candidate Daniel Cameron beat Democrat and former State House Speaker Greg Stumbo. Cameron is the state's first African-American Attorney General and the first Republican to win a race for the office in 70 years. Republicans got another victory in the Secretary of State race, where GOP candidate Michael Adams pulled out a win over Democrat Heather French Henry. In both races, Democrats are losing those statewide offices. Beshear was the previous Attorney General and current Kentucky Secretary of State. Laundering crimes is term limited. Despite Kentucky being one of five states to hold its gubernatorial elections on years without federal elections to draw big attention, it's been a bruising contest between the two, focusing on tough questions around the region's aging Brent Spence Bridge, the state's ailing pension fund, related sick outs by the state's public school teachers, health care policy, abortion, and other big issues. Bevin's term in office has seen a number of controversies, including contention over his move to end the state's Medicaid expansion, potentially costing up to 400,000 Kentuckians their health care, questions around the sale of a mansion, the Bevin's family by a donor, and uproar from some in Kentucky over comments he's made about vaccinations and cold weather school closings, as well as his suggestion that Kentucky students experience molestation or abuse during a public teacher sick out. That sick out came as a protest against moves Bevin's has made to try and shore up the state's ailing pension fund, which is deeply underfunded. Beshear had a controversy of his own to contend with, allegations of corruption against his Deputy Attorney General Tim Longmire, who in 2016 was found guilty of accepting bribes during his time in Beshear's father's Governor Steve Beshear's cabinet. There's not any evidence the younger Beshear knew about those bribes, but his primary opponent, Adam Edelin, used the incident to attack Beshear. Sorting out the election has a fairly tight deadline. The Kentucky Board of Elections is set to certify the results by November 25, and Kentucky's constitution requires the next governor to be sworn in by December 10. Beshear says he's looking ahead to his term in office. Whatever process the governor chooses to go down, it's not going to change the overall number of votes, he told reporters at a news conference November 6. We're going to take the steps to move forward to make sure that we are ready. Next article from the City Desk, and this also is by Nick Swartzel. Portune Cranley pitch deal at the banks. After protracted battles over a music venue at the banks between the city of Cincinnati and members of the Hamilton County Commission, there may be a truce on the table involving a deal to divvy up the remaining undeveloped lots at the riverfront development between the city and the county. That's the deal Cincinnati Mayor John Cranley and Hamilton County Commission member Dodd Portune hashed out, according to a news release Cranley's office sent November 5. The agreement, if approved by Cincinnati City Council and Portune's two commission colleagues, Denise Driehaus and Stephanie Summerall Dumas, would allow the county to move forward with developing MIMI's, M-E-M-I apostrophe S, music venue, relocating Hilltop Basic Resources, which currently sits on the space, and delivering 3,200 surface parking spots promised to the Cincinnati Bengals in exchange for their approval of the music venue near Paul Brown Stadium. All those points are important for the county because they allow it to delay many millions of dollars in stadium upgrades and other payments it would otherwise have to provide under its contract with the Bengals. In return, under the Cranley-Portune deal, the county would not interfere with any city efforts to develop lots 1 and 13 at the banks, which are also near the stadium to the north. Currently, both the city and the county had to give joint approval for any development at the banks. Earlier this month, the city proposed a new zoning plan for the banks that would make things difficult for the county as it works to move forward with the MIMI venue under a tight time frame ahead of a competing venue in Newport. Portune compared this to a declaration of war against the county by the city. Cranley's long been critical of the deal struck by the county with the Bengals, saying it will cost taxpayers in the end and that the planned parking promised to the Bengals is not a good use of land on the riverfront. The mayor also opposed development of the venue by MIMI, saying he preferred a competing plan by Columbus-based Promo West and wanted the venue built on Lot 24, where the Bengals have no say over the development's height. Cranley, however, says he's worked out those disagreements with Portune. Commissioner Portune and Mayor Cranley have worked together to come to an understanding that will advance future development at the banks, the release from Cranley's office said. The broad outlines of the deal. The city will not develop a lot it owns at 3rd Street and Central Avenue so that the county can use that through 2026 to provide some of the promised surface parking for the Bengals. The county will get exclusive development rights over Lot 24, where Cranley has pushed to move MIMI's venue, and Lot 25. The city's recent zoning proposal excluded residential uses at those lots, something the county has wanted to do there since Lot 24 does not have the same height restrictions as lots closer to Paul Brown Stadium have. The county will give the city the right to develop Lot 1 and Lot 13, keeping them from being used for surface parking. The Bengals will still have a say in the height of buildings on those lots, but the county promises that any subsequent deals with the team will not impose more restrictive stipulations on those lots. Under the deal, the county would also construct a parking garage on the lots. Tax increment financing money from the lots would go toward paying off another garage on lots 23 and 27, then would go toward the construction of the garage at lots 1 and 13. After that, the TIF money would be split by the city and county. The city will work with the county to explore placing decks over Fort Washington Way. The city and county will explore a revenue-sharing agreement for proceeds from the SkyStar Observation Wheel Attractions lease at Lot 18 at the banks. The city would use its portion of the proceeds for upkeep at Smale Riverfront Park. Under the agreement, the Cincinnati Planning Commission and Cincinnati City Council would still need to give final approval for MIMI's music venue. And with that, it looks like my time's up. This is David Ness. Thanks for listening in to the radio reading service. Have a nice day.